yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. The show, Alternative Visions. We talk about the problems of the day, the issues, and the solutions. Okay, well, what's the issue of the day? Well, the government shutdown, right? Well, that's not the only issue of the day. There's lots of issues going on. There's the problem in the rollout of the Obamacare legislation. Well, that's a longer-term issue here, and we're not going to jump at that immediately today. We're going to wait till next week, see how this thing shakes out a little bit, and have some guests on next week and talk about the Obamacare implementation and the issues surrounding that. Of course, that's not unrelated to what's going on today with the government shutdown, right? Republicans, T-Publicans in the House are making it a big issue here. Pretty much saying, you know, either gut it or eliminate Obamacare, defund it, whatever, in whole or part, or, you know, we're not going to play ball with you guys in Congress and Obama administration anymore. We're going to go home. Well, look, folks, this is just theater. This is theater. This is not real. This is not even about today. It's about elections next year. It's all about posturing by politicians for the 2014 midterm elections. And if you think a government shutdown today and the debt ceiling issue that is coming in just a matter of weeks, another debt ceiling debacle, is bad this year, wait till next year. Next year, right before the midterm elections, then you're going to really see a fiasco. It's going to be a repeat. This is just the dress rehearsal. And they will come to a solution on this. As I predicted on this show and in my writings and blog posts and so forth in recent months, this is not the real shutdown that's coming. Oh, okay, but it is affecting people in real terms and so forth. But, you know, what's interesting is the stock and bond markets aren't even hiccuping over this, are they? They're not worried. The shutdown doesn't affect them much, first of all. And secondly, they know a deal's in the works. Okay, what they're much more concerned about is not the government shutdown. They're more concerned about the debt ceiling crisis that comes up on October 17th. And the big risk here is the two will be integrated, that the shutdown thing will drag on for more than this week, remainder of this week, although I don't believe so, and sort of have a confluence with the debt ceiling issue that comes up next. Okay, we'll talk about this a little bit more here shortly. But what we're seeing in a broader sense today is a crisis in capitalist economic policies, not just fiscal policies, which is about government spending and taxes, and the debt ceiling, funding the debt and deficit the debt. That's all fiscal policy. We're seeing greater instability occurring across the board in various elements of fiscal policy. But we're also seeing a crisis in monetary policy. Now, those are the two main policy tools that capitalists and corporations use to try to stabilize the economy. And neither are working. 5 years after the recession, and more than 4 years after the so-called end of the recession in June 2009, we have growing instability and ineffectiveness in fiscal and monetary policy. As I've said earlier on other shows and in my various articles predicting the course of the U.S. economy and global economy, you can read those, by the way, on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Or go to my website, which is Kiklos Productions, spelled KYKLOS productions.com/articles, /articles. Or if you want to listen to my presentations, public audio and video presentations, that would be /interviews. KKLOS Productions /interviews. And you can get my views in greater depth as well. But I've been saying there are three great possibilities for tripping the U.S. economy into a real bona fide double dip. So far since 2009, we've been going up and down, bouncing along the bottom. All right, short, shallow recoveries followed by short, shallow declines. Growth rate, you know, somewhere around 1% on average, up and down, up and down. Last year it's been about 1.7% last 12 months. That growth rate is really historically low. Historically low. Typically, it's twice that at 4 years after the recession ends. If you look at the 10 prior recessions in the United States, at this point, we would have increased GDP, total output of goods and services, after 4.5 years, about 15 to 17%. So far, we've increased GDP only 8% over the last 4.5 years. 8%. In other words, the recovery is about half of what is normal in the United States. Now, keep in mind that recovery, half of normal, is after trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars of fiscal and monetary stimulus. That makes it even more dramatic. The Federal Reserve, as we will see, has pumped somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion into the economy. Now, into the economy means mostly into the bankers and investors, who, instead of investing in the United States, are hoarding their cash or sending it offshore to emerging markets, mostly in Asia, or using it to buy back stocks, or paying out dividends, or investing in financial securities around the globe, causing speculative bubbles elsewhere, instead of using it to invest in the United States, dribbling into the United States investment. So $10 to $20 trillion, most of it's gone offshore or elsewhere, not creating jobs and so forth. But it's $10 to $20 trillion. Really the product of the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, which we will see, not Congress. It's not government spending. Okay. And then we have fiscal policy. We've had trillions of dollars in additional tax cuts, mostly business investor tax cuts. And the same thing has happened. They're hoarding it. Multinational U.S. corporations are sitting on over $2 trillion in their offshore subsidiaries. Banks are sitting on over $1 trillion in excess reserves and so forth. The money's out there, but it's going somewhere else, or it's being hoarded, but it's not being used. So we've given investors and corporations trillions of dollars in tax cuts, with the same result that we've gotten from the Fed pumping money into the bankers and the economy. It's not getting down to anybody. That's the problem. Okay. And earlier this year, we had the so-called fiscal cliff. Remember that one? Oh, that was all about the Bush tax cuts. Fiscal cliff was about Bush tax cuts and extending those tax cuts. They expired, or were supposed to expire, in December 2010, but Obama extended them. A freebie of about $800 to $900 billion in more tax cuts, 80% which go to corporations and wealthy investors and wealthy households. Okay, and they were supposed to expire again last December 31st, 2012, which they did. And the Obama administration and corporations got together and finally convinced the Tea Publicans in the House that it was to their advantage to extend $4 trillion more in tax cuts over this decade. $4 trillion. If the Bush tax cuts had been extended in toto, it would have been $4.6 trillion of tax cuts, mostly again for rich and corporations and wealthy investors, just a dribble for the rest of us. $4.6 trillion. Okay, so they extended $4 trillion permanently. and they fattened the inheritance tax and alternative minimum tax and so forth. It was a great deal. The fiscal cliff was a great deal for wealthy folks, investors, and corporations. They got to keep $4 trillion forever now. There's no expiration date, you see. And that was the so-called fiscal cliff. I remember everyone saying, oh, it was going to be big crisis. Well, corporations blocked with moderate Republicans in the Obama administration put pressure on the radicals in the House. After all, they pay for their elections, right? And they came around and they agreed to that. And I've been predicting there will be a similar agreement here. Because behind the scenes, what's happening is we've got this big revision of the U.S. tax code working its way through the House of Representatives, chaired by the Republicans. And when that comes into the mix, you have the conditions for a deal similar to what happened with the fiscal cliff. Right now, it's all theater. They will come to an agreement on this. And yes, in the meantime, average folks will be hurt. Public workers won't have any jobs. They'll lose money with all their furloughs, and lots of folks everywhere across the country are going to be harmed. But, you know, what do they care? They don't care about average folks. They care about their banker and business friends who pay for their elections. That's who they care about. And all the rest is theater. And they will come to an agreement. So don't get too upset with this shutdown. The debt ceiling is more serious for them, but they will come to an agreement on the debt ceiling, too. You know, look, what has been the record, Republicans, on this debt ceiling thing? Well, they keep it going, because it's a nice issue for them, and they'll extend it, but not for more than a year, because they want another bite at that apple, another shutdown crisis, another debt ceiling crisis next year. Right before the midterm elections. Okay. We have a dual fiscal crisis, shutdown, debt ceiling. But there's also a third here, and that's the sequestered spending cuts that are only now, effective October 1st, really starting to bite. Remember the sequestered, you know, that came up with the fiscal cliff, too? Fiscal cliff was extending the Bush tax cuts, and it was also the $1.2 trillion in spending-only cuts that were to take effect on January 1st of this year. They pushed it off 2 months, and it took effect March 1st. Well, that's only a half-a-year impact. But now we'll start seeing a real impact with the sequester. So we have a triple fiscal crisis going on. Debt ceiling, shutdown, and sequester. A fiscal perfect storm coming together, which will have an impact on an already weak and fragile, if you can call it, economic recovery in the U.S. I can't call it an economic recovery. We still have 22 million people officially unemployed in this country. Let's see what the jobs numbers are this coming Friday. At best, they've only been creating enough jobs to absorb people entering the labor force. That's why we still have 22 million and almost 14% unemployed. Still, forget those numbers they give you in the papers. That's the conservative partial unemployment rate called the U3. The U6 is the real unemployment rate. And that's at 13.7% unemployment, 22 million people without jobs, and it's probably higher than that. Okay. And retail sales are slowing in the U.S. They've had the worst back-to-school sales period here in recent weeks in years. And with all this shutdown and debt ceiling and sequester hitting, and the government still laying off public workers, there's no real income growth going on for the 100 million middle-class, working-class households in this country. In fact, real income, real disposable income, continues to decline 1 to 1.5% per year. Yes, some recovery since 2009, huh? With everyone's real disposable income declining? Is that a recovery? 22 million jobs, is that a recovery? they talk about the housing market recovering. Well, most of that, three-fourths of that are refi loans. That's not real first-time construction going on in new homes and people buying new homes. Now, there's a little bit of that, but that's being squashed, stalling rapidly as well. There's no real recovery going on in this country. When you look at real people, recovery for businesses, for corporations, bankers, investors, wealthiest households. Oh, by the way, just a week or so ago, we had the latest report from Professor Emmanuel Saez of UC Berkeley, who's done some real yeoman work for the last 10 years about income inequality trends in the United States. Since 2002, his first studies, based on IRS data, the best data, not the data you get from the Commerce Department, which doesn't include capital gains income for the rich, but the real data, or as close as you can get to the real data, because the rich, you know, they still avoid taxes by putting their money offshore in Cayman Islands and other shelters and so forth. But, you know, that's closest to the reality. And what did we see with Professor Saez's results, his latest results? As I said, he's been issuing since 2002. We see that since the recession ended, the wealthiest 1% have accrued to themselves 95% of all the income gains since 2009. Well, no wonder the rest of us are going backwards 1 to 1.5% per year. The wealthiest 1% have taken all the money increases, all the gains, all the increases. You know, I read some of these liberals, Robert Reich and Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman and others, in recent years, they've discovered income inequality. Well, that's great. I'm glad they have. But there's been data on this going back to 2002 that's been absolutely clear and unequivocal. You know, during the Bush period, all the income gains, 65% of all the income gains went to the wealthiest 1%. During the Clinton period, 45% of all the gains went to the wealthiest 1% during his term in office. And now under Obama, 95% of all the gains are going to the wealthiest 1%. We not only have income inequality in this country, we have accelerating income inequality in this country. Well, no wonder consumption, 70% of the economy, keeps bouncing along the bottom, and we can't get the recovery really going. Because there's no real income gains. You know, if you look at the jobs created since the beginning of this year, in other words, January through August, over 1 million jobs created. 700,000 of those have been part-time temp jobs, paying 60-70% of a normal wage and virtually no benefits. Yeah, job creation. Tell me about it. Now, the Federal Reserve says, QE3, I'll explain what QE is in a minute, QE3 will create jobs, and that's why we're going to do it. What is QE3? What is QE? Quantitative easing. What is that? That's where the Federal Reserve, the central bank of the United States, prints money and then turns around and uses that money to buy up the bad bonds that investors are holding, you know, the subprime mortgage bonds, some treasury bonds, etc. So it prints the money, buys the bonds, puts the cash in the hands of these investors, takes the bonds off the hands of these investors. Now, most of these are subprime bonds, which means they've collapsed in value. So the Fed is buying these bad bonds from investors, paying them good cash for it that it prints, and taking it off their hands. Now, how much is it paying? How much is the Fed paying for these bad bonds? We don't know. Why don't we know? Because the Fed doesn't have to tell anybody about individual transactions. In fact, it won't even tell Congress. We don't know what they're paying for. You can bet they're paying above market value for many of these, I would bet. Okay, so direct subsidy. How much has this cost so far? how much has the Federal Reserve spent on QE? It's about $4 trillion since 2009. It's come in four iterations. There was QE1, $1.75 trillion in 2009. The economy slowed, nevertheless, in 2010. Oops, so then we get a QE2, $600 billion, and a little boost to the economy. And in 2011, it slows again. Then we get QE 2.5, called Operation Twist, $400 billion, and the same up-down. And then finally, last year, we got QE3. Now, how much is QE3 worth? Well, we don't know because it's open-ended. In other words, the government, the Federal Reserve, is printing $85 billion a month in buying these bonds. $85 billion, and it's open-ended. Sometimes called QE infinity, because who knows when it's going to stop. So already, it's over $1 trillion, and by the end of the year, $1.3 trillion. Well, you add all that up, what do you get? You get about $4 trillion in printed money buying these bonds, putting cash in the hands of these investors, bankers, financial institutions, insurance companies, hedge funds, blah, blah. And what are they doing with the money? Well, as I said before, they're hoarding it. They're putting it in their offshore tax shelters, Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Seychelles, Vanuatu. That's where all the money is being hidden. So Uncle Sam doesn't know and can't tax it. How much? Oh, gee. You know, it varies. Estimates somewhere between $7 and $11 trillion is now estimated by investment banks to be stuffed in these offshore shelters. And the IRS can't get at it. Okay. So, and what are they doing with it? Well, they're investing in foreign exchange currencies, speculating in Chinese property, Hong Kong property, business property, junk bonds all around the world, corporate bonds, etc. Foreign exchange derivatives. That's where all the money is going. You see, we have a global financial capitalist system. A global money parade. And there's huge amounts of liquidity and money out there. But it's not being used, as in the past, to finance real investment. It's being used to speculate in financial securities. Sloshing around the world, what I call the global money parade in my book, Obama's Economy. And generating these speculative bubbles everywhere. Okay, so we have a triple fiscal crisis, as I said, hitting all at once. The shutdown, the debt ceiling coming up, and the sequestered. But we also have a monetary policy crisis with the Fed's QE policy. That's the $4 trillion. Now, that's not all of what the Federal Reserve, the central bank, has done to pump money into bankers and investors. That's just one of its policies. The other policy is what's called zero-bound interest rates. In other words, drive interest rates for the last 5 years down to near zero. Allow the banks to borrow from the Fed at near zero interest rates. As a result of these policy, the rates average or range, let's say, rather from one-tenth of 1% to three-quarters of 1%. Wouldn't it be nice to buy a home at three-quarters of 1%? Well, the banks can do that. They go and borrow, and then they charge us. You know, interest rates now for 30-year fixed up over 4.5%. They get free money, not only in the form of QE, but they get virtually free money borrowing from the Fed. In fact, they can borrow from the Fed and then leave the money at the Fed, and the Fed will pay them interest. Interest they don't even have to pay back, right? When you look at the total Fed monetary policy liquidity money injection, it's somewhere over the last 5 years between $10 to $20 trillion. Injected into the bankers and the financial institutions and the wealthy investors, the hedge funds, you know, insurance companies, so on and so forth. And that's kept the global capitalist financial banking system from collapsing in a classic depression scenario like the 1930s. But it hasn't stimulated the real economy either. These guys go off, and as I said, you know, they pay back, buy back their stock. They pay dividends to their big investors. you know, they go speculate in foreign exchange and properties and real estate and so forth around the world. That's what's fundamentally changed in 21st century capitalism. The Fed, QE, and other monetary policies have been an abject failure. As I said earlier, the U.S. GDP has cumulatively grown only 8%, half of what is normal after 5 years. 22 million jobless. Right? By the way, the Fed justified, let's do a little calculation here, justified its QE3, most recent version, $1 trillion so far pumped into the banks, justified it that, well, we're going to use that to reduce the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate has drifted down less than 1%, and that's due to factors other than QE. But, okay, let's just assume that the Fed spent $1 trillion to create 1 million jobs. That's about half of the jobs that have been created the last 18 months, about 1 million. Let's assume that the Fed's responsible for half of that. It can't be responsible for all of it because there's other forces at work here. But let's just assume the Fed created 1 million jobs, but it cost $1 trillion. Well, that means $1 million per job created over the last year. If the Fed is correct, it's creating jobs, reducing unemployment, it's doing so at $1 million per job. Now, the average annual income of jobs created is about $35,000. So where did the other $965,000 per job go? Who got the other $965,000 that the Fed pumped in at $1 million per job? Well, it's gone to bankers and businesses. Talk about trickle down. This is the worst trickle down rate we've seen in the half century. 35 for me and 965 for you. That's trickle down today. Not working. When you trickle down only that much, you end up with declining disposable household income for 110 million households earning less than $100,000 a year. That's the rest of us, you know. That's what you end up with, and thus no recovery. But it sure pumps a lot of money into the bankers and into the hedge fund guys and all the other wealthy households who are now getting 95% of all the income gains. Okay. What has the Fed and QE accomplished since 2009? Well, record banker profits, bonuses, and wealthy household income. That it has accomplished. Okay? But it has also accomplished the creation of financial bubbles and speculating around the world, similar to what happened before the crash in 2007-08. Again, Chinese property, U.S. land prices, junk bond, corporate bonds, so on and so forth. That's what it has done. But now it's facing a contradiction. Contradiction that Fed monetary $10 to $20 trillion liquidity injections are having less and less effect even on the U.S. real economy. And more impact on generating speculative bubbles around the world and creating currency wars. Okay. Now, the Fed recently realized this contradiction and has attempted earlier this year to try to withdraw some of that excess liquidity into the global economy. And the result was almost another financial crash. Okay, I'm going to come back and explain that. That's called the tapering. The Fed trying to taper, reduce, in other words, its QE, $85 billion a month, free money injections. Okay, what happened? We'll come back here after a short break and talk about the consequences of the Fed trying to reverse this disastrous QE monetary policy. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Be back in a moment. Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, let's summarize what we've said so far. Yes, we're all aware of the fiscal crisis with the government shutdown and all the brouhaha and hullabaloo that's going on around that particular issue. But that's only part of the fiscal crisis facing us. The other is the debt ceiling coming up, and it's really going to be dangerous if the two end up in a confluence here. But behind the scenes, we got the sequester beginning to bite as well. So we have a triple fiscal crisis. In other words, the picture is one of just a churning in terms of solutions on the fiscal side, and nothing's really happening. I'll explain why. This is all part of what I call austerity American style. All right. So, but then I want you to think about the fact that we're also immediately in the midst of a monetary policy crisis, not just a fiscal crisis, and that has to do with the Federal Reserve's policy of quantitative easing and zero interest rates, pumping trillions, tens of trillions of liquidity money into the economy, mostly through the bankers and financial institutions. But that is no longer working either. In fact, it's becoming counterproductive. It's having less and less effect on the real economy, and we see that with jobs, housing, and so forth, and simultaneously causing more speculative bubbles and global financial instability. And the Fed knows this. And the Fed, therefore, earlier this year, this past summer, decided, well, we got to wean these folks, these investors, stock, bonds, derivatives, so forth, off of their addiction, and it is an addiction to the free money they're getting from the Fed. You see, for 5 years now, they've been getting free money, and they've come to expect it. And if you take the punch bowl away, they go into fits. Take the financial free money punch bowl away, and they throw themselves on the floor and whine and squeal and thrash around and so forth till you bring the punch bowl back. And that's what's happened over the summer. The Fed, Federal Reserve, U.S. Central Bank, at the end of May, gave a signal, a very cautious signal to these investors and markets, saying, hey, you know, look, it's not having as much effect, and we're going to have to start withdrawing some of this money because it's just way too much we've pumped into the global economy. And you guys, and we don't know what impact this is going to have down the road. It could be very negative and cause another financial crash eventually and so forth. So we're going to start taking some of this away. Well, the taking away was called tapering. Tapering of QE. Tapering of the $85 billion a month, you know, with no end in sight, of free money, buying up bonds at subsidized rates and prices. Okay, as soon as the Fed said that, well, what did, quote, the markets do? Stock and bond, derivative, exchange, et cetera, markets do. Well, they had a financial fit in June. And they began thrashing around, complaining. And as a result, interest rates started rising significantly in June, just in a matter of weeks, just as a result of the Fed indicating it might do something. It hasn't done anything yet, just that it might. They quickly went into a fit, and interest raised interest rates, and the real economy began to slow down. The housing market was just struggling to recover. Boom! Mortgage rates went from 3.5% to 4.5% in a matter of weeks and almost stalled the entire housing, quote, recovery. That's on 30-year fixed mortgages. Other bonds rose. Bond prices rose. Okay. Interest rates rose, rather. Bond prices fell. Over 1%, just in a matter of weeks. In other words, the markets, and, you know, I hear this term, the markets. You know, they, financial folks like to talk about the markets as if they were depersonalized beings. Well, who are these people? They're the big bankers. They're the wealthy investors. You know, they're what we call very high net worth individuals who earn $25 million or more every year. Not what they're worth, but liquid flow. $25 million or more a year. Very high net worth individuals. You know, and these are the guys who drive these markets and their institutions that they invest in, you know, their hedge funds, their private equity firms, and their asset management companies, and so forth. quote, they are the markets. They're real people behind this stuff. Okay. So, you know, they responded negatively, and interest rates went up significantly. Now, what that did is not only slow down the, began to slow down the economy in the U.S., the domestic economy, as rates rose, but began to cause serious problems elsewhere in the global economy, particularly in what's called emerging markets. Emerging markets, where a lot of this $10 to $20 trillion of the last 5 years has flowed to, stimulating their economies, you know, Indonesia and China and Brazil and so on and so forth, they've been doing pretty well because all the money has flowed offshore into them to expand their economies, not the U.S. economy or the European economy or Japanese economy, but offshore. Okay, so all that money started flowing back from the emerging markets to the U.S., to Europe, as a result of interest rates rising in the U.S. as a result of talking about tapering. It caused increasing crises in those emerging markets. And who are these main emerging markets? They're called the BITS, B-I-I-T-S. You heard of the BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, BRICS. Well, the BITS are Brazil, India, Indonesia, Turkey, and others. And all this money started flowing back, capital flight to the West. Their currencies began collapsing. They then began raising domestic interest rates to stem the outward flow of capital, and that slowed their economies in turn. In other words, this Fed thing has global implications, and the rest of the world began slowing down and growing financial instability as well. So the Fed backed off. You know, the big investors in the U.S. and problem global markets backed off in July. And the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke came out and said, well, we really didn't mean all that. No, we didn't mean that. You know, we're not going to taper. Oh, and then, boom, there goes the bond markets back up again. Oh, stock and bond markets take off again nicely. And then the Fed began to signal its other governors, you know, there's 12 governors of the Fed, began to come out and signal again, even more cautiously in August, that, well, you know, maybe at our September meeting, Fed gets together all the governors and Bernanke and so forth, decides what they're going to do periodically. And then September 17th meeting, before that, they said, well, maybe we're going to have to maybe think about tapering again. Well, then the markets and the stock and bond markets, the big investors freaked out once more, and we went back to another decline in stock and bonds periodically, and then the Fed met on September 17th and said, no, we're going to continue this thing. So two taper signals and two retreats from tapering, and the markets are happy. Right? Stocks and bonds have resurged again. Well, what this means is that investors have a stranglehold over monetary policy in the U.S. and globally, by the way, because we'll see the rest of the world has been following the Federal Reserve's QE and zero interest rates. In fact, that's the main capitalist policy tool for the last 5 years. It's not fiscal policy, it's that. And investors are addicted to the free money is what it means. They can't get off of it. They can't go cold turkey, and the Fed has no methadone interim solution. So we're going to see more financial paroxysms and fits to come in the global financial economy as the Fed desperately tries to reduce pumping that massive amount of money into the wealthy investors who are just sending it around the globe and speculating in markets everywhere. They got to get off of it somehow, but they can't. Every time they do, you know, here comes a threat. We're going to bring down the entire system. We like this free money. It's super profits. It's 95% of all the income we get as a result. Right? So Fed monetary policy may be at the end stage of its effectiveness. Less and less impact on the real economy, greater, more and more negative impact on the global economy and financial markets, but the Fed can't get off of it. After 5 years, the system is addicted to it. And this has been going on globally as well. You know, in the UK, they got their version of QE and zero rates. And now, the Cameron government over there, the Tories, the Conservatives, are pumping even more money, causing a new housing bubble. And who are you pumping it into? Well, you're pumping it into your banker and financial friends. It's called the city, London. The city of London, yes. Another euphemism for the big British banks. Okay. So they're pumping even more money, creating another housing bubble a la 2007 over there in order desperately to get the economy going somehow. And the Eurozone, the European Central Bank, the 17 countries in mainland Europe there, rates of 0.5%, right? Same as the U.S., and what they call the long-term refinancing operation, LITRO, in which in 2011-12 they pumped about $1.5 trillion. And now they're talking about even more. LITRO, LTRO is our equivalent of QE. And they're talking about even a new LITRO. So they keep pumping money, just like the Fed, you know, pumping euros into the economy, and the UK pumping pounds into the global economy. And now Japan recently shifted and did the very same thing earlier this year. They got their own version of QE, and they're pumping money into the economy. It's runaway. It's a runaway train. Here. It's a runaway monetary policy train globally, and they're all following the U.S. Now, what about fiscal policy? The second tool, not very effective. U.S. fiscal policy, well, we got a little stimulus back in 2009, $787 billion, Obama's first stimulus bill, right? And another $30 billion on top of that with the cash for clunkers auto policy and first-time home buyers, which have been repealed. So, I mean, let's say maybe $1 trillion of stimulus in 2009-10. Most of that, by the way, was tax cuts for investors and subsidies from the federal government to the states. And there was nothing directly guaranteeing job creation. It was one of the worst constructed fiscal stimulus packages ever in U.S. history. And it dissipated after a year. And in 2011, when the Tea Party takes over the House, ever since then, ever since 2010, November 2010, we've been in a let's retract that original fiscal stimulus, as poor as it was. And they've been doing that. You know, in August 2011, the debt ceiling deal ended up with $1 trillion agreed by Obama and the Democrats to retract. Cut spending in the U.S., $1 trillion. And what did they get for it? Nothing except an agreement that the Republicans wouldn't raise the debt ceiling issue until after the 2012 national elections. Well, it's after, isn't it? Yes. So we took $1 trillion out. We reversed, in 2011, we reversed the $1 trillion stimulus of 2009. And then we have the sequester, which is another $1.2 trillion spending cut. We are in an austerity mode, or what I call America, austerity American style. You can read that article as well on my blog or in various magazines. Yes, we are in a retraction mode on fiscal policy. And now the Republicans want another bite at the apple of that austerity. That's what it's all about, you know. Attack Obamacare and take that stimulus out, because that involves the government putting money into the economy, and let's at the same time cut entitlements. You know, that's behind the scenes here. You're going to see that emerge soon. Obama's already agreed to cut $630 billion from Social Security and Medicare in his 2014 budget that they're fighting over. That's going to go up for sure. All right, the shutdowns are taking money out of the economy. Right? So all of this is all part of austerity American style. Now, austerity is even more draconian elsewhere in the world. If you look at the UK under Cameron, you know, they've had even a worse austerity program. They're dismantling their healthcare system over there. They're driving people from subsidized homes out into the street, and they're raising the cost of education. In other words, make the people pay while you pump trillions of dollars into the bankers and hope that they will trickle down at 965-35 ratio. Okay? And now they're talking about even more subsidies for mortgage banks and investors, creating the housing bubble over there. So it's the same thing. Austerity on the fiscal side, free money on the monetary side. Free money is being rendered counterproductive, and austerity is making things worse. Well, why do they do this? Why are they, when there's no clear record that austerity is stimulating anything, are they adhering to austerity? Because they really believe that all it takes is put money in the hands of the banks and the rich and the corporations and the rest of the economy, if you just tough it out and wait, we'll recover on its own. And in the meantime, let's hold the deficit down by making people pay. That's the essence of the global capitalist strategy, not just in the U.S., but in the U.K. and in the Eurozone as well. Austerity policies, especially in the southern tier, Greece, Spain, and so forth. Once again, you know, they have their version of QE, they have their version of zero interest rates, and they have their austerity policies, making everyone pay in the meantime and hoping if they just wait long enough, it will correct itself. I mean, after all, let's wait. We're doing great. We don't need any more. We got all this income gains and all this free money. You know, hey, recovery looks pretty good to us, you know. Who cares about the rest? Let them tough it out. Everything will come back. That's what they're depending on. That's what their policy is all about. Free money plus hold the line and squeeze everybody else. That's the global capitalist coordinated now, coordinated globally. This is not just U.S. U.S. is leading the charge, but they're all following the same policy set. Primary reliance on monetary policy and free money, and let's squeeze the rest of the folks to keep the deficit from rising too much, and we'll just wait. And things will get better. After all, we can afford to wait. Right? That's what we're seeing here on a global basis. You may have wondered why, with all the shutdown of the government, that stock and bond markets aren't too upset, are they? You don't see any crashes going on. You don't see anything really crisis mode in stocks and bonds, do you? Because they know the government shutdown doesn't affect them. Right? No impact. In fact, you know, in the other government shutdown we had in 1995-96, no impact whatsoever on stocks and bonds. They just blew right through it. Investors know that the government shutdown is not significant. And in any event, they also know it's theater and it's going to be resolved with no impact on them. Now, however, if this thing gets to the debt ceiling deadline on October 17th, then that's something they are more concerned about because that affects their stock and bond prices. You know, the markets, quote, the market, stock and bond markets, are concerned first and foremost with whether the Fed will continue its free money, its QE, and not taper. That's what they're first and foremost concerned about. Secondly, they're concerned about, oh, what's happening in the real economy in the U.S., Eurozone, China. You know, what's happening really with jobs in the U.S., retail sales, housing. And, you know, what's happening with the banks in Europe and what's happening in Italy now, which is the focal point of the crisis over there. What's happening with Chinese manufacturing and exports, emerging markets, and so forth. That's what they're really interested in. They're watching those economic indicators. They're not watching the shutdown and whether we get a debt ceiling extension, which I say we will also get. We will get this. Don't fret. It's not the end of the world. It's the capitalists playing games with you all. And they will maneuver this crisis somehow to make sure they get more tax cuts. After all, Obama's agreed to cut the top corporate tax rate from 35 to 28%. Multinational corporations are lobbying hard to keep their $2 trillion offshore, or if they bring it back, to pay only 5 to 10% instead of 35%. They'll get that. And they'll bring, you know, a few hundred billion of that back. They did this already in 2004 and 2005. You know, this is just a repeat by the multinationals. They got to bring back $500 billion, promised to create jobs, didn't do it, used the money to buy back stocks, pay out dividends, buy up their competitors, and their corporate rate was reduced from 35 to 5.5%. Well, they're doing the same thing. They got away with it once. Why shouldn't they do it again? And that's exactly what's happening with this major tax code change. You know, that's the big unforeseen chip here behind the scenes. And that will work its way into these negotiations before year end here. Right. But the shutdown is nowhere on the radar screen of importance to markets, stock and bond markets. Right. We will see what happens if the two continue. In other words, the shutdown drags on for several more days past this week, which odds on won't happen. And whether it sort of integrates with the debt ceiling deal on October 17th, which is more important for them. For them. Okay. Okay. And that will be the test, whether this thing goes on for two more weeks. But then, you know, you won't be able to tell if it's whether the debt ceiling is causing the crisis or the government shutdown. You know, government shutdown causes crisis for government workers and for people who receive social services and so forth. In other words, the rest of us, debt ceiling doesn't really impact us, but vice versa. You know, the wealthy are more concerned about the debt ceiling. And but even that, I don't think, is going to be the big showdown, because it makes no sense. It makes no sense. Have the big showdown next year, really do the theater and the posturing before the elections, the midterm elections in 2014. That's when you do it. And I think they understand that, too. But, you know, right now, the Ted Cruz's and, you know, the other radicals in the House, they got to look as if they are really opposed to this Obamacare. I don't think they really are. Why? Because, boy, it's a nice whipping post, isn't it? Just keep whipping Obamacare and ACA, you know, Affordable Care Act here. It's a nice issue. Keep this thing going. In fact, we want to keep this thing going until 2016 and run on it in the national elections in 2016. It's a wonderful issue for them. And I don't think they want to really get rid of it. They want to chip away at it, show that they're achieving something, and they're already proposing, the Tea Publicans are already proposing partial solutions to it. We'll see whether Obama holds tight and agrees to no concessions on it, or whether he agrees to more concessions on it. You know, he's done an awful lot of unilateral concession since he got into office here. The biggest, of course, was to get rid of the public option on health care. And then earlier in the year, several weeks ago only, he let the small businesses off the hook, extended the mandate for a year. There are other measures that he's unilaterally withdrawn from Obamacare since January of this year. He's made major concessions and offers on cutting Social Security and Medicare and other entitlements. And, of course, the Republicans, Tea Publicans in particular, you know, like mad dogs, bite his hand and say, give us another one. And he extends the hand again, and they bite it again. You know? So I guess never learns either that or this is all theater on both sides. Both are colluding and dancing. A well-orchestrated dance going on here on this fiscal thing, and has been since the fiscal cliff of last year. Okay. To sum up then, fiscal and monetary policy are both entering a period of increasing crisis in the United States and increasing ineffectiveness, and ineffectiveness in terms of stimulating the real economy and ineffectiveness in terms of causing more instability in the financial sector and economy. Question is, going forward, what are these guys going to use? Okay, in my book, Obama's Economy, Quiver Few, I say that traditional fiscal monetary policies like this just do not work, and the proof is the last 5 years. And what is needed is a major restructuring of the U.S. and global economy. And that restructuring has to be a number of provisions that redistribute income in the United States to consumer households and eliminate debt, expunge debt from consumer households. And what we need is a public banking system where QE is not given to the rich, but given to people who can really stimulate the real economy. Okay, but you're not going to hear that, and you're not going to even hear it from liberals like Krugman and others, because they're still wrapped up in the same policy mix that their opponents are. All right, this is Jack Rasmus. Next week, we're going to have guests and talk about Obamacare and its implementation, now that things would have shaken out a little bit, and see what's going on there. Alternative Visions. Talk to you again.